great lover of nature. She was one of those people born in the Edwardian era who could name almost any wildflower she saw on the long walk she took every day, and who could also pick out and identify a bird from a few bars of birdsong. So she was walking with her was to enrich one's whole experience in a way that made walks something like going to a wonderful museum. And one of the poets that I was, when I was very young, I remember her reading to me, and that meant a great deal to me, was by the romantic poet Walter de la Mare, who was hugely popular to the end of the Victorian and Edwardian era, and who shared some of my mother's feeling about nature. And I'll just read a couple of verses from that. It's called Farewell, and it looks as if it's towards the end of life, but I actually found it as a poem that completely enriched life all the way through, from childhood onwards. When I lie where shades of darkness shall no more assail mine eyes, nor the rain make lamentation when the wind sighs, how will fare the world whose wonder was the very proof of me? Memory fades. Must the remembered perishing be? Oh, when this my dust surrenders, hand, foot, lip to dust again, may these loved and loving faces please other men. May the rusting harvest hedgerow still the traveller's joy entwine, and as happy children gather posies once mine. Look thy last on all things lovely, every hour. Let no night seal thy sense in deathly slumber, till to delight thou hast paid thy utmost blessing. Since to all things thou wouldst praise, beauty took from those who loved them in other days. The second poem that I want to read to you.
Absolutely.
Is also a sense of poem by somebody celebrating the beauties of creation, but a very different sort of person. Gerard Manley Hopkins, who is perhaps one of the greatest poems of the Victorian era, a man who was very much able in his early life to enjoy everything around him, who went to university, got a great deal of pleasure out of reading and listening to music, but then became increasingly conscious of the fact that he felt he had another calling. And that second calling, which is a difficult one for him, was to become a priest at a time when the Roman Catholic Church was still something of an outsider in British society. He had the ability and the academic standing to become a professor, an academic, and did indeed become an academic at Oriel College, Oxford. But in the end, the power of his calling made him feel that he had to abandon poetry, that poetry was in some way in conflict with what he saw as the ascetic life that a priest should live. And he became a Jesuit and then a priest. His beautiful poem, which was something to do with his early stage where he was, as so to speak, in love with nature, some of you will know quite well. It's quite a short poem, but I think it's a very beautiful one. It's also in many ways a very modern one. It's much more modern in its style than Walter de la Mare, who was very much a child of the Romantic movement towards the end of the 19th century. It's called Spring. Nothing is so beautiful as spring, when weeds and wheels shoot long and lovely and lush, and thrush's eggs look little lower heavens, and thrush through the echoing timber does so rinse and ring the ear, it strikes like lightnings to hear him sing. The glassy pear tree leaves and blooms, they brush the descending blue. That blue is all in a rush with richness, the racing lambs too have fair their fling. What is all this juice and all this joy? A strain on the earth's sweet being, in the beginning in Eden garden. Have, get before it cloy, Christ Lord, and sour with sinning, innocent mind and mayday, in girl and boy, most, O May's child, thy choice, and worthy the winning.
Did your parents read that to you? I mean, is that how you were introduced to it?
One of the real reasons for this is my father was born of an Anglican vicar father, who actually served not far from here. He was a vicar in the Church of Wales and ended up as a vicar in Llandrindod Wells, being partly Welsh. My father, who was his only son, his only child actually, became increasingly attracted while he was at Oxford to Roman Catholicism, and followed very closely almost all the writings of John Henry Newman, who later became the first Roman Catholic cardinal since the Middle Ages, towards the end of the Victorian era. My father followed, in a sense he was an interesting case. He wasn't a straightforward convert. He was entirely an intellectual convert. He was persuaded by reading the works of Newman that the Roman Catholic Church was the appropriate place for a Christian to be. And so I followed my father in reading. In fact, he used to read Newman to me. He also used to read Aquinas in Latin, being, I think, persuaded that rather like John Stuart Mill, one can suddenly make a genius out of one's child by expecting much more of them than they were capable of being able to understand.
True.
Anyway, to cut a long story short, my father was drawn to Cardinal Henry Newman, came across the Oxford movement when he was in Oxford, having been through the war and gone to Oxford afterwards, and then finally ended up by becoming a Roman Catholic himself, very much so. He's quite a pious Roman Catholic. And so I think he then introduced me to Gerard Manley Hopkins, as well as to Cardinal Henry Newman, and that's where this poem came from.
And when you and I were young, I mean, Hopkins was considered quite a difficult and modern poet, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Undoubtedly, I at school was first introduced, aged 12, to the Windhofer, and I've loved Hopkins, and it was the first sort of non-Victorian, because you described him as Victorian, but he's really a 20th century poet, isn't he? He spans the gap. And I was amazed how I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight, stofar, dapple, drawn, falcon, and his riding underneath him, steady air. And I find it quite, amazingly, I find it quite easy. And I won the Loder Declamation Prize, age 12. I've loved Hopkins and ever since. But it's interesting that that we were both introduced young to Hopkins, and I've loved him ever since.
Can I add just one thing about him? His decision to not continue writing poetry once he became a Jesuit priest was made more intense by the fact that he also thought that it was, in a sense, a pleasure he shouldn't have to see his poems published. And what many people don't realise to this day is that this man, who was later seen to be one of the greatest of the poets of his century, had almost none of his works published during his lifetime. They're almost all posthumous, which is very surprising, but almost as if you said to a bird, I'm going to remove your vocal cords. It was as if he was then forced by his own, essentially, decision to resist things that most drew him, most attracted him, then he was silenced as one of the really great poets until after he died.
Now, your next two poems are rather different and rather more surprising after De La Mer and Hopkins. E. Cummings, and then, well, not the old isn't surprising, but E. Cummings, I didn't expect you would choose a Cummings, and I was really pleased that you did. But I've come to him rather recently. I mean, I was always put off by his using the lowercase.
Not only does he use the lowercase, he does all kinds of things. He splits words.
Yes.
He splits sentences. He suddenly runs off in a direction which is not the way the poem seems to be going. But he is a marvellous, amazing poet. I mean, partly he has an extraordinary kind of exuberance and an innovatory quality, which is quite remarkable. He had several wives. He was rather given to having different wives. And he wrote about each one of them absolutely beautifully. But they didn't last. They tended to get discarded after about 10 years. But in the course of their marriage, they mostly were married, not all, you got these beautiful poems. I mean, absolutely exotic, erotic, romantic, all those things. But the one that I chose is rather different. Shall I read it?
Oh, please, yes.
You have to listen very carefully to this. It's quite hard to follow. From spiraling ecstatically, this proud nowhere of Earth's most prodigious night, blossoms a newborn babe. Around him, eyes gifted with ever keener appetite, than mere a miracle can quite appreciate, humbly in their imagined bodies, kneeled over time, space, doom, dream, while floats the whole perhapsless mystery of paradise. Mind without soul may blast some universe to might have been and stop 10,000 stars, but not one heartbeat of this child, nor shall even prevail a million questionings against the silence of his mother's smile, whose only secret all creation sings.
Thank you.
Now, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm going to have to go and read it. I said all many people in this room who don't know it, like me, are going to have to go and read it afterwards carefully. Thank you very much.
I think, actually, I've come to the conclusion that when I first read it, I thought it was a poem about the experience of one's first child, whether one was the mother or the father, that feeling of a miracle being born, which happens to be your child. On rereading it, I think increasingly it probably is about the birth of the Christ child, that famous phrase about whose only secret all creation sings. But please read it more than once and decide which you think it's all about, because it's very difficult to say.
Thank you. Your next choice is W.H. Auden, absolutely one of Musée des Beaux-Arts. It's one of my absolute favourites and one of the great poems that describes a great painting.
Let's give you a little bit of background to this one. You've got to think of Auden probably having recently been in a museum, looking at some of the great medieval paintings of the major events of the universe, all kinds of major events. But think of Bruegel, both father and son. Think of people back to that era, because you've got to see that as the background against which this amazing poem is written. And I'll say one other thing about it when I've ended. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating, or opening a window, or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who didn't especially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreaded martyrdom must run its course, and that in a corner, some untidy spot, where the dogs go on with their doggy laugh, and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for example, how everything turns away, quite leisurely, from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not important, not an important failure. The sun shone, as it had to, on the white legs, disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship, that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to go, and sailed calmly on. The story I want to tell you very briefly is that I live in Hertfordshire, rather close to the Henry Moore Foundation, which is in Perry Green in Hertfordshire, where Henry Moore insisted that many of his sculptures be exhibited freely to the public and in the open air. And one of the sculptures in that foundation, which you can go and see just by walking around, is Icarus fallen onto a hill. And you can see it from a long way away, this extraordinary figure, distorted, wounded, a kind of epitaph to man's endless ambitions and aspirations to be something else.
And, I mean, I'm sure you, it's a poem that I suspect many of us read again and again and again, but go back and look at that painting again, because it's a really wonderful painting, isn't it? Right, on. What is next, Shirley?
Well, the next one I've got is quite different, but so I decided it was getting a bit gloomy. So we should go back and look at one or two other poets, and the one I chose is, oddly enough, John Dryden. Now, John Dryden was seen by many people as the great poet of the Restoration, by which I mean the Restoration of the monarchy after the Civil War. And he was, like many people in that era, he was rather adaptable. He started out by being mildly in favour of Cromwell. He wrote a poem or two at Cromwell's funeral, which he was asked to do. He then sort of felt the way things were going. He probably licked his finger and held it up and felt the wind and decided this was not the right way to go. Twisted back and found himself very close to Charles II, became, before long, poet laureate and a keen royalist, and adapted himself for whatever the situation might be. And this was one of the short pieces he wrote at that time, and he was enjoying the figure of being Britain's favourite poet for the Restoration. It's called From the Secular Mask, and it's a dialogue, and I'll read it very quickly. The personae dramatis, or actors, if you like, are called respectively Janus, Cronus, and then again Cronus. Janus, Cronus, Cronus, mend thy pace. 100 times the roiling sun around the radiant belt has run in his revolving race. Behold, behold, the goal in sight. Spread thy fans and wing tiny flight. Then our age was in its prime, free from rage and free from crime. A very merry, dancing, drinking, laughing, quaffing an unthinking time. Then our age was in its prime, free from rage and free from crime. A very merry, dancing, drinking, laughing, quaffing, and unthinking time. All in all, of a piece throughout, the chase had a beast in view. Thy wars brought nothing about. Thy lovers were all untrue. 'Tis when an old age is out, and time to begin anew. All the piece throughout, thy chase had a beast in view. The wars brought nothing about. 'Tis well an old age is out, and time to begin anew. This, of course, was Dryden's explanation of his rather surprising U-turns. But if I may put it in its context, the reason I've written it here is because I remember my very favourite English teacher from my school days, 30 years before I got to read this poem, suddenly sent it to me out of the blue when we founded the Social Democratic Party, of which she became a key member. So I thought you would probably appreciate that. And I was amazed because I hadn't read Dryden for years, but I became devoted to Dryden after that and wanted indeed to have time to begin anew.
I don't think we do these Desert Island poems about 3 or 4 times every festival. I don't think we've ever had a Dryden fall, not that I can remember. And it's lovely. The other, of course, great poet of the Restoration, in my view, was John Wilmot, the Earl of Rochester, who was an ancestor of mine, the Mad Earl, the Libertine. One day somebody will choose him, I hope. Now, are you going to read
Scott? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm glad you said that, though, because one of the things about Dryden was that the New World built around Charles II was an escape from many of the very sharp manacles applied by the Puritans to the British spirit, and clearly Dryden wasn't really, in the end, very much in favour of that. One of the great men that I met in the course of my political life, and you will understand why I pick on him, because in some ways he was, for me at least, the outstanding example of an age anew, was Charles Kennedy, who sadly died only a few months ago. He was a good friend of mine. Together we worked very hard together to try to stop the invasion of Iraq, which we were both felt would be a very unwise way to go. But he also was a man who, inside himself, had an extraordinary quality of, how can I put it, exuberance, life, leadership, happiness, humour, all those things. And I'm going to read just two paragraphs from his neighbour in the Borders, Walter Scott, who was himself, of course, born in Edinburgh, got polio as a child, was heavily lame in consequence, was then sent to the borders in order to recover. The borders were thought of as being kind of local Switzerland of Scotland. And he went to the borders and got to know the borders and all its legends very well. Sir Walter Scott. And I'll read these two poems, which for me, two verses rather, which for me remind me always of Charles Kennedy. O young Lochinvar is come out of the west, through all the wide border his steed was the best, and save his good broadsword he weapons had none. He rode all unarmed and he rode all alone, so faithful in love and so dauntless in war, there never was knight like the young Lochinvar. He stayed not for brake and he stayed not for stone. He swam the Esk River, where ford there was none. But ere he alighted at Netherby Gate, the bride consented, the gallant came late, for a laggard in love and a dastard in war was to wed the fair Ellen, a brave Lochinvar. So boldly he entered the Netherby Hall, among bridesmen and kinsmen and brothers and all. Then spoke the bride's father, his hand on his sword, for the poor craven bridegroom said never a word. O come ye in peace, or come ye in war, or dance at our bridal, the young Lochinvar.
I'm so glad you chose that, because Charles and I were elected on the same day in 83, and he was a wonderful man and a real loss for the whole country, I think. Very, very sad. Now, your next poem is a wonderful poem, I think, by Matthew Arnold, Dover Beach. Is that the next poem?
Matthew Arnold is in some ways a rather different figure than some of the people we've already talked about, and I have a special feeling for him because some of you will know, but not all of you will know, that he was, of course, Her Majesty's Inspector of Schools. And having myself been Secretary of State for Education and Science, one of the things I came to appreciate very much was that Her Majesty's Inspectors of Schools were a very different set of creatures from Ofsted.
Yeah.
To my mind, one of the great things about Her Majesty's Inspectors were that they attempted to befriend teachers, to advise them, to stand with them, to be associated with them. And I don't want to be rude, but I don't feel quite that way about Ofsted. This is by Matthew Arnold. Some of you will know it. It's a great poem called Dover Beach. The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast, out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long lines of spray, where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at the return up the high strand, begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle hurled. But now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind, down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. Our love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie in here like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new.
You read that beautifully, Shirley. And isn't he amazing the way that he got the sound of the water on the shingle and the tide? It's an extraordinarily evocative piece of writing. Now on a bit into the 20th century. To Stevie Smith, is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. I like Stevie Smith very much. I don't know if many of you read her, but she's very enjoyable. She's a very down-to-earth sort of writer, but also she says very deep things in a very simple, straightforward language. And this poem is a very good example of that. and something that many of you may feel has happened to you or people that you yourself know and love. Nobody heard him, the dead man, but still he lay moaning. I was much farther out than you thought, and not waving, but drowning. Poor chap. He always loved larking, and now he's dead. It must have been too cold for him. His heart gave way, they said. Oh, no, no, no. It was too cold always. Still he died, one day moaning. I was not too far out of my life, and not waving, but drowning.
Lovely, thank you. And now, Eliot?
Yes, just a little bit of Eliot. The two poets I love most in my own century are Eliot and Auden. Eliot's very complex, and one of the things you might enjoy my saying very quickly, as already said by Mark, I spent some of my life in America teaching, first of all, as a scholar, and then later teaching at Harvard, and I also married an American, a wonderful American, who was a great expert on the presidency, called Richard Neustadt. And in the course of my being in America, particularly Massachusetts, I spent quite some time trying to find the last of the four quartets, the places from which it came. It starts with East Coker, which is where Eliot's British family had lived for centuries before. And then after that, you work your way through the other of the four quartets. But the ones I could never find were the ones that were called the Dry Selvages. I couldn't even think what a dry selvage was. And one lovely summer weekend, I was staying with friends of mine in Cape Ann in Boston, beyond Boston, in Massachusetts. A marvellous European scholar called Stanley Hoffman and his wife. And we looked out to sea. They had a little house right at the very edge of the sea, looking over the cliffs into the sea. And all of a sudden I saw the sea breaking and breaking and breaking over the same group of completely concealed rocks under the sea. And I said, goodness me, that's very dramatic. What's that? And they said, that's the Dry Selvages. And that was the last of my four quartets, which brought me back to discovering Eliot. This is the sixth, but I'm going to read them all just a little bit, the sixth section of his great poem called
Ash Wednesday.
Ash Wednesday. The whole series is called Ash Wednesday. This is just the last part. It's quite difficult. Although I do not hope to turn again, although I do not hope to turn, wavering between the profit and the loss, in this brief transit where the dreams cross, the dream crossed twilight between birth and dying, bless me, Father, though I don't wish to wish these things from the wide window towards the granite shore, the white sail still flies seaward, seaward flying on broken wings, and the lost heart stiffens and rejoices in the lost lilac and the lost sea voices, and the weak spirit quickens to rebel, for the bent golden rod and the lost sea smell, quickens to recover the cry of quail and the whirling plover, and the blind eye creates the empty forms between the ivory gates, and smell renews the salt savour of the sandy earth.
Loved it. Did you by any chance hear on Radio 4 about a month ago Jeremy Irons reading Prufrock? He read it wonderfully.
I read it many times. I didn't hear him.
But
it's a marvellous poem.
We would be very nice if we can get Jeremy Irons next year to. And I rather hope he might read The Wasteland for us. I mean, but he is a terrific.
That would be a wonderful.
It would be a good event. Do you agree?
Yes.
Good. Chloe is listening. She's a wonderful director, but I don't think she needs any encouragement to that sort of thing. Right, where were we? Yes.
We are the last one or two.
Yeats, yes.
Yes. Yeats. As well, I must say the other poem, I think, the poet that I think increasingly means a great deal to me as I read more and more of him, was, of course, that strange man, William Butler Yeats, who was indeed a leader of the Irish revival. Not just in poetry, but in the arts more generally. was one of the founders of the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, wrote some absolutely wonderful poems himself and was inspired in many ways by the Irish battle to be accepted and to re-establish Irish culture. And of course, at the beginning of his life, he was very much moved by Irish legend and by Irish occult memories. But as he grew older, became moved away somewhat from that and became much more part of the world that was all around him. The one bit I'm going to read here is called The Sorrow of Love. It's very Yeatsian. Yeats suffered more than most from the sorrow of love, and of course, as many of you know, was profoundly in love with that rather mad lady.
Maud Gonne, yes.
Maud Gonne, who I think gave him a hell of a hard time, and whom he adored more and more, the worse she was to him. He was one of those men who do exist, who really sort of suffer from masochism at the hands of various powerful women.
She was very beautiful, though, wasn't she?
She was very beautiful, but boy, she was hard to live with. Right, here we go. The brawling of a sparrow in the eaves, the brilliant moon, and all the milky sky, and all that famous harmony of leaves, had blotted out man's image and his cry. A girl arose that had red, mournful lips, and seemed the greatness of the world in tears, doomed like Odysseus on the labouring ships, and proud as Priam, murdered with his peers. Arose, and on the instant clamorous leaves, a climbing moon upon an empty sky, and all that lamentation of the leaves couldn't compose man's image and his cry.
Do you like, as I do, that wonderful Yeats poem, A Prayer for My Daughter?
Yes.
Which is, do you know that? Just a wonderful poem. Once more the wind is howling and half hid under the cradle hood and coverlet my child sleeps on. He wrote it as a riposte to Maud Gonne, and it was a cry of anger about how she didn't understand how what a woman should be, and she was all the things that he didn't long for in a woman, but he loved her. But it's an extraordinary poem. He said, but it's that first few lines is as good as about the buffeting of the wind as Arnold is on the tide and the water and the shingle.
Equally boastful. Let me just give you four lines from Yeats. Well, boastful about being able to remember poetry. Let me just quote four lines from Yeats, which seem horribly appropriate for the present time. Things fall apart, the centre cannot hold. The best lack all conviction, and the worst are full of passionate intensity. That poem is now repeated over and over again, and it sounds awfully like the world that we live in.
Absolutely. And then finally, is it finally?
Finally.
Sadly, but we'll leave some time for questions,
really, yes.
Because I can just feel that people want to ask you things. A final Auden, Friday's Child.
Indeed. This Auden, as some of you know, was started life as in many ways a young radical. And one of his wonderful poems is called Spain, just called Spain, which was about the Spanish Civil War, which was the civil war that in many ways defined the differences between the old established conservative regimes of Franco and the challenge of the new democracy, which was the case with the loyalists. My father actually worked with and served with the loyalists in Spain, although he was a Catholic, because he was passionately in favour of the sustention of Spanish democracy. And actually, now, a long story I won't tell, except to say, he escaped from the siege of Barcelona by borrowing a soutane from a local priest who lent it to him, which got him through Franco's lines and back to England. In later life, Auden, who had gone to America and then come back and gone to Austria, became quite deeply religious. And his religious writing is, to me, extraordinarily relevant to the modern world. He doesn't try to wash away everything and turn it into traditional religion. He addresses the issues of the time. This is a little long, but I'll read it not too quickly, because actually, in my view, every single verse is worth listening to. This was in memory, by the way, this poem, which is called Friday's Child. And I hope all of you in Ledbury will remember that line of descriptions of the days of the week. Monday's child is fair of face, Tuesday's child is full of grace, Wednesday's child is full of woe, Thursday's child has far to go, Friday's child is loving and giving, Saturday's child is all spread of living, and the child that was born on the Sabbath day is blithe and bonny and good and gay.
I was born on the Sabbath day.
And so was I. So there, I got two. Anyway, this poem by Auden was written in memory of that great martyr, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who from the middle of his prison in Flensburg under Hitler went on repeating and staking the Christian message. He told us we were free to choose, but children who were, we thought, paternal love will only use force in the last resort. On those too bumptious to repent, accustomed to religious dread, it never crossed our minds. He meant exactly what he said. Perhaps he frowns, perhaps he grieves, but it seems idle to discuss if anger or compassion leaves the bigger bang to us. What reverence is rightly paid to a divinity so odd if anger or compassion leaves the bigger bang? Sorry. What reverence is rightly paid to a divinity so odd? He lets the Adam whom he made perform the acts of God. It might be jolly if we felt awe at this universal man. When kings were local, people knelt. Some try to, but who can? The self-observed, observing mind we made when we observe at all is not alarming or unkind, but utterly banal. Through instruments at its command, make wish and counter-wish come true, it clearly cannot understand what it can clearly do. Since the analogies are rot, our senses based belief upon, we have no means of learning what is really going on, and must put up with having learned all proofs or disproofs that we tender of his existence are returned unread to the sender. Now, did he really break the seal and rise again? We dare not say. But conscious unbelievers feel quite sure of judgment day. Meanwhile, a silence on the cross, as dead as we shall ever be, speaks of some total gain or loss, and you and I are free to guess from the insulted face just what appearances he serves by suffering in a public place, a death reserved for slaves. I found that a most marvellous poem because it addresses the scepticism that is implicit in people with a scientific background in our age. It doesn't try to pretend that there are things that are certain that we aren't sure are certain. But in the end, what it says is that the victory of the cross was a greater victory than the victories of many, many powerful men and women.
I'm really grateful to you, Shirley, because I thought I knew Auden pretty well, and his collective works are thumbed heavily by Jill and me. But I'd never read that before, and I'm really grateful to you.
It's not widely known.
And I may not be the only person in the room who was grateful to her for that. It was amazing. I wanted to leave some time for you, because I sense that you want to have the opportunity to ask some questions of Shelley. Is that all right, Shelley?
Of course. Yes.
Lovely. So, would people indicate... Angela, can you see anybody? Ah, there.
There's one here.
Two here.
Do you want me to speak?
We got a mic at all.
We've got a mic, Polly. No, we haven't. You have a speaker. I am struck by the fact that so many people listen to poetry and are moved by the words of what seems to them to be truth, but do not listen with such eagerness the words of politicians.
For very good reason.
Well, but I'm not wanting to be cynical, but what is it about how language is used in these different contexts?
Very good question. What do you feel?
It is a very good question. I think you could say that at their best, even that wretched profession known as politicians, are capable of trying to inspire. You probably would dismiss Ed Miliband or the Prime Minister or what have you, Nick Clegg. But if you were a South African and you heard Nelson Mandela when he came out of prison in 1994, you would have listened to something that would move you as much as poetry, if not more. So I think, with great respect, that the mistake that one makes is to put the context, and often the context is one of conflict, of finding the faults with one another, to overcome the power of the words spoken by a person with a powerful vision, a powerful dedication, and a powerful purpose. If you put it in those contexts, you could listen to Pericles, you could listen to Mandela, and you would hear the voice and the words with the same power and the same conviction that you do when you listen to the people that I've been reading about.
But would you not agree, Shirley, that depressingly small number of colleagues in the House of Commons or the House of Lords, probably not true of the Lords to the same extent, read very little poetry? One of the most depressing experiences I had as Minister for the Arts, very briefly, was that not only had Tony Blair never read any Scott at all, he did claim later that he'd read Ivanhoe, the novel, but I don't think he had. He certainly hadn't read any Scott or Burns, but worse, he wasn't even ashamed of that. He felt, why should I? I'm a politician. And very few, and it's why it's been so refreshing this afternoon that you have such a feel for poetry and you do read, but too few. If more politicians read more poetry and read a poem each morning, I think they would their own language would improve a lot.
They used to. I mean, I honestly think that one of the things that one has to take into account is that one of the awful things about the 24/7 news flow, all of which politicians are supposed to be on top of, because they don't know what they're going to be asked in every radio program or television program, so that they feel obliged to read everything about everything very quickly and very, very unsubtly, if you like. But the public will blame them if they don't know exactly what happens right now in Greece or in Manchester or whatever it may be. It means that you don't have people spending the kind of time that a Gladstone, or for that matter, a Disraeli would have spent. Time that also enabled them to write themselves, and sometimes write poetry themselves. So I think it's too easy to just smash the profession. I think part of it is this colossal pressure of speed and time nowadays.
But don't you think the politicians would be better off if they did read a poem or two a day? I mean, Jill and I always start of the day by reading to each other two or three poems, and it settles you for the day, and it gets your mind working. And,
have you read The Ragbags?
The Ted Hughes anthologies. Yes, it's good. I mean, but I think Neil Astley's are even better. And there's a lovely anthology, which I suspect lots of you know, called Poem for the Day, A Poem a Day, which has a terrific range of stuff in it. And very good notes at the bottom of the page.
I'm pleased to say I read that regularly.
Absolutely. Isn't it lovely? Next question. No more time. Can we have one more question?
There was somebody...
Ah, right.
Excuse me, Dame Shirley and Mark. I was just wondering, you were obviously involved in the education as a minister. Do you feel nowadays that there isn't enough poetry in the school? Are people more concerned with Twitter and the quick, instead of opening a book, a quick tweet and this sort of thing? Or do you think that Twitter can be used to enhance poetry?
Well, I will ask Mark to forgive me for repeating something I've already said to him, but I wrote an article about 5 years ago which was called The Winnowing Out of Happiness, and it was about education. I think in our schools, not so much primary schools, certainly secondary schools, we've become so exam dictated to, so overcome by the need to get marks on our league tables, that we've forgotten that education actually is about lighting a fire in the mind of a child. And I think we see it in primary school still, but secondary schools have become in many ways a deadening experience for many, many young people.
But I must say something to blow the trumpet of the Poetry Festival, because Chloe and her team and the festival as a whole has a wonderful record of working with schools. As Adam Munte, who is a key member of the festival, said, I think yesterday in a meeting, we reach 2,500 children every year, and when children hear a poet reading their own works, the whole thing comes alive, and they understand and feel for poetry much more. And I'm very proud of what Ledbury Poetry Festival does with children every year, outside of the week of the festival. You've been a wonderful audience. Thank you very much indeed.